At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Are you nervous out there, a little economically anxious, uncertain perhaps? It's all right, don't worry, we got just the thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 19th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is a thing that happens to you when you're a business and economics reporter and the economy starts looking a little screwy. People stop you in the supermarket, at a dinner party, when you're out and about, and they say, man, what is going on? That, to me, is always a sign there is a story there that needs doing. So with new and not great numbers out of China today, oil prices still slicker than anything, and stocks, well, you know what we always say about stocks, but the markets are making people nervous anyway. With all of that, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore got the lead assignment today. What is going on?
Meh is not an official economic term, but it's a pretty good word for the global economy today, which on average is growing about 2.5, maybe 3%, depending on who you ask.
It's not doing particularly well.
Tam Bayumi is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. China is slowing as it shifts from manufacturing to services. Brazil is in recession, and emerging economy growth fell for the fifth consecutive year. On the other hand, the U.S. is doing okay, 2.6% growth and near full employment.
Europe actually is beginning to improve a little bit.
Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board.
You know, we talk about the economy. These are actually big amorphous things, and they don't all move at the same time.
But that fundamentally is part of the global economy's problem right now. Not only is everything moving in different directions, there's no one big mover for better or for worse. Wyn Thin is global head of emerging markets at Brown Brothers Harriman.
Eurozone, Japan, China, a lot of the big countries that normally provide some global growth, they all have some question marks.
So it's not like there's a giant rotten plank in the global economic ship that's about to give way, but it's not like there's some pillar of strength we can moor to either. In fact, economists and investors are hard-pressed to explain exactly why things are so muddled, and that makes people and markets nervous.
You know, the world economy on the whole, it's still very, it's too much piglet.
Matt Slaughter is dean of Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, and he is talking about Piglet from Winnie the Pooh.
He's not anti-Piglet. He's a cute character, but Piglet was anxious. For jobs and communities, we want a little more Tigger, a little less Piglet. And definitely no Eeyore.
In other words, says Abdur Chowdhury of Marquette University, things aren't great, but things aren't terrible.
I don't see any reason to panic.
Just tell that to Wall Street. No, really. Someone just tell that to Wall Street. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, so oil, I mentioned it up on top. Let's revisit for just a second here. One thing that markets look for when things get screwy out there is stability in the price of oil. Today, however, is not that day. The International Energy Agency put out a report this morning suggesting the world's relative glut of oil is going to continue well into this year. That's due in part to more Iranian crude coming online as sanctions wear off, as you've been hearing since the weekend. And that, in turn, is enough to upset the already teetering balance between crude supply and demand. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Hear now the words of the IEA. The market could drown in oversupply of oil. World supply could outrace demand by 1 million barrels a day for the third straight year. A big reason? Iran wants to export more crude with sanctions lifted. Energy economist Guy Caruso is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
What it would require would be deep discounts to lure a buyer away. So if you've got Iran there saying, okay, we'll give it to you for 25, so you don't have to pay the Saudis 28, you know, they might lure a little bit away.
Indeed, today the Chinese president is in the Mideast, presumably shopping. Now, just a tiny oversupply in the world can shoot prices down dramatically. Why? Well, because it's hard to get rid of the extra. It's not like you and I are going to drive one additional carpool or rush out to buy a guzzler, says Tufts University economist Gilbert Metcalf.
You may, in fact, say to yourself, gas is only $2 a gallon right now, but geez, I'd hate to buy a Hummer and have the price go up next year to $4 a gallon. People are not going to change their behavior that much in the short run.
Now, the $5 word for all this is inelastic demand. Though at the gas pump these days, it's more of an under $2 word. At some point, more drillers will go under at these prices, supply will slow, and demand from the world's drivers will catch up, and prices will recover. But until that balance comes, cheap oil will remain a good deal for consumers, but a scenario for more carnage for producing companies and for petro nations. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One more thing about oil before we move on, by the way. A barrel of it at today's close of $28.46 per in New York. A barrel of crude costs less than the barrel it comes in. Think about that for a second, huh? There's a whole bunch of other stuff oil is cheaper than, too. We've got a list for you to check out at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, yeah, you know, it was fine. Not great. Not terrible. Whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Emily Guerin, who's reported stories for us a bunch of times, moved to North Dakota to cover the Bakken oil boom back in June 2014. Crude was above $100 a barrel then, and as we all know, today it is not. So instead of covering a boom, Emily has found herself covering a bust. And along the way, she's gotten some unexpected personal finance advice, too.
People don't come to the Bakken oil field because it's a nice place to live. They come to make money.
There are more oil rigs than trees, and we are from the Pacific Northwest.
That's Dee Dee Andrews. They're here for her husband Kevin's pipeline job.
We're thriving, but it's not home.
But the Andrews are not your stereotypical oil workers, spending their bundles of cash on big trucks, trips to Vegas, flat-screen TVs. The Andrews are really frugal because they want to go home eventually.
We just recently moved into a fifth wheel.
That's an RV. There's not a ton of privacy. The neighbors are 10 feet away.
He blows his nose at 5:30 in the morning, and it's so loud that it wakes the cat up.
But they pay about $1,000 less per month than they would for an apartment in nearby Watford City.
We're saving up for a nice piece of property with trees and a river, and once that's paid off, we'll go home, and we'll eke out an existence at $15 an hour and be happy.
And that was my first lesson. Don't adopt an expensive lifestyle that traps you in a job you hate. Lesson number two.
Don't borrow any money.
I would say debt can really hurt you.
You need to save as much money as you can. Put it away. Don't buy new things.
That was three small oilfield business owners. Rusty Briggs, Bob Ayala, and Rory Anderson. They've been through booms and busts before, and that's the advice they gave younger oilfield workers. Debt is especially dangerous in an unstable industry like oil. Truck driver April Boyce learned that in March when her boss suddenly cut her hours way back as the price of oil plummeted.
It used to be that you get called out. I mean, you get called out at 4 o'clock in the morning and, you know, be doing runs until 10 o'clock at night, just one after the other. And now you're just kind of living in limbo on standby.
Sitting around in coffee shops, waiting to get called out to haul something from one oil well pad to another, Boyce started analyzing the sacrifices she was making to be in the Bakken.
And you've abandoned your family, your friends, and your comfort zone back home to make money. You know, and now they've kind of turned the spigot off. The money has stopped flowing, and so I just said it's not worth it.
Boyce taught me lesson number three. If you're in a job that's not ideal, don't lose track of why you were doing it. Know when it's time to leave. A lot of people here are like that. They come and go as the opportunity arises. Rusty Briggs knew he wanted to move to North Dakota when he walked into a gas station here at 4:30 in the morning, one day back in 2011.
Everybody's in their Carhartts. You can't get to the counter. It's going, and that's when I just immediately called and said, we got to move.
He was working as a land developer in Oregon at the time. He'd also done construction, while in firefighting, and he was a logger.
This is probably my third or fourth job change.
Whenever one of those industries started to fade, he'd switch to something else. For now, he owns an RV park in the Bakken. But if it empties out with this bust, he'll change jobs again.
I've had the best time of my life being an entrepreneur in the last 5 years, whatever it's been. And you can't beat being here, you know. And it's all a chance.
Briggs taught me the fourth and final lesson. Don't be afraid to totally reinvent yourself, which, given the uncertain state of journalism these days, is probably pretty good advice. In North Dakota, I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
Emily's story was produced for us by Inside Energy. That's a public media collaborative covering this country's energy issues. Say this about the Oscars. They know how to generate buzz, although this likely isn't what they had in mind. The backlash over this year's all-white slate of nominees is building. Spike Lee and Jada Pinkett Smith have said they will boycott the ceremony on February the 7th. George Clooney weighed in on Hollywood's lack of diversity today. The head of the Academy issued a statement last night saying, in part, they need to do more to increase diversity and do it better and more quickly. Todd Boyd teaches cinema and media studies at the Film School at the University of Southern California. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me get right to it. Do you think the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and the Oscars are losing credibility at this point?
To me, it's not an issue of credibility. It is a issue of whether or not the film industry is operating in a way that is consistent with the environment that we live in. This is not the 1940s. It's 2016. It's the era of the nation's first African-American president. So I think, you know, there's a light being pointed in Hollywood's direction right now. It's a critical light, and it's necessary for the industry to take heed and to do something about this if they want to be able to continue to exist and have a positive representation in the culture at large.
Part of what's going on here with the white slate of nominees is because the Academy is overwhelmingly white, it's overwhelmingly male. I wonder, though, if part of it isn't because films that might have gotten nominations with minority actors and directors, like Straight Outta Compton, like Creed, didn't get the push from the studios, didn't get the marketing push that maybe some other films did. What do you think of that?
Well, I think we need to be careful because, you know, the Academy Awards are very subjective. Mm-hmm. I think it's less about, you know, something being excluded or snubbed because, of course, every year there are going to be performances and movies that get left off for a variety of reasons. The bigger issue, however, is the fact that the industry itself is not diverse and is not inclusive. And so what we need to focus on is what takes place on the front end. Who runs the studio? Who has the power to say yes? Who has the ability to hire people to cast certain films? These are the sorts of things that I think are more important than ultimately who gets nominated or who wins the award, because at the end of the day, there's always going to be arguments about somebody being excluded from the Oscars for a variety of different reasons. The bigger picture, however, is the lack of diversity and inclusiveness in the industry and the way in which this has has denied people opportunities.
This is a really depressing thing to say, but it sort of sounds like you are trying to get the point across that we're focusing on the wrong thing here with the Oscars, and everybody needs to just step back and say, listen, there's a systemic problem here, and get over yourselves.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, we live in the age of social media, and it's as though there's a new controversy every day.
Yeah.
Social media almost demands that. You know, how long are we going to talk about, you know, the Oscars until the next social media controversy emerges? And they are not seeing the bigger picture. It's not about arguing over Straight Outta Compton or Creed. I mean, you know, if you like those movies, fine, and they didn't get nominated, you know, you can sort of be upset about it. But, I mean, there's some years when there are multiple African-Americans nominated. A few years ago, 12 Years a Slave was Best Picture. So, you know, you kind of have to look at this from year to year. The last 2 years have been overwhelmingly white, but I would suggest that every year has been overwhelmingly white when we get beyond the acting categories and we look at the sort of larger industry. So you can focus on the Academy Awards. That's a big, shiny object that has everyone's attention. But unless there's some larger structural and institutional changes, then the Academy Awards are only going to reflect the decisions that they make on the front end. And that, I think, is ultimately the bigger issue.
Dr. Todd Boyd is a professor of cinema and media studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, just down the road from us. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up,
Congress received more mail over these efforts related to dietary supplements than they did about the Vietnam War.
What you don't know might indeed hurt you, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 27 points today, a tenth percent, closed at 16,016. The NASDAQ down 11 points, about two-tenths percent, 44.76. The S&P 500 added 1 point, less than a tenth percent, ended at a neatly palindromic 1881. Morgan Stanley beat profit expectations for the fourth quarter. The stock gained 1%. Goldman Sachs reports tomorrow. It banked up 0.7% today. Told you earlier about volatility in oil. Lower prices, however, can make a difference if you're, say, an airline. Take Delta. They reported lower fuel costs helped last quarter. Stock up 3.2% today. United Continental fell, however, 1%. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.05%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The floodwaters that hit St. Louis, Missouri over New Year's have mostly receded from their record levels. Now, though, comes the cleanup, and it is going to be expensive. Yes, there's insurance, but so too are there insurance headaches. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum takes a look at why the recovery around St. Louis could come with a big, big price tag.
You don't typically find a lot of people lining up to get pizza at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But that's exactly what happened recently in a white tent in Eureka, Missouri. Scores of hungry residents from the St. Louis suburb came to this temporary outpost to help out Joe Bacardi's, a restaurant decimated by the region's historic flooding. That includes Barb Henneisen, who's been a loyal customer since the eatery started serving up pizza pies 45 years ago.
We've had floods similar before, but not near as high. We've seen the devastation before, but not to this degree.
Like other businesses hit hard by the flood here, Joe Bacardi's didn't have flood insurance. The eatery had never flooded before, and paying the premiums on the insurance is expensive. But now that means there's no obvious source of money to replace equipment or for renovation efforts. And owner Ray Bacardi says that will make it tough to repair hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage.
Not only do we not get insurance on the rebuild, we're not getting insurance on lost business, we're not getting insurance on loss of product or anything. So basically, they kind of left us high and dry because of the fact that we didn't have the flood insurance.
If you looked at this aerially, as I did, it was tens of square miles covered in water in St. Louis County.
That's St. Louis County Executive Steve Stanger. His administration set up a no-interest loan program to help out businesses wrecked by the flood. And it's possible that businesses could benefit from low-interest loans from the Federal Small Business Administration. But Stanger says there are limits on what government can do in this situation.
So they made a calculation over those period of years to not have flood insurance, and now the flood has hit. So that's going to be up to the individual business owners. From the perspective of St. Louis County, we're going to do everything we can to assist. But they are private, you know, business entities.
Even for businesses with insurance, recovering from the flood won't necessarily be a quick or easy process. In the nearby city of Pacific, a historic opera house that once hosted Missouri political legend Harry Truman suffered a lot of damage from the flood. And for the building's co-owner, Tom Daly, getting back to normal isn't cheap.
We got insurance, but we got a hell of a deductible. That's better than no insurance at all, though, I guess.
That deductible is $50,000. Still, some officials like Julie Wood aren't totally pessimistic about recovery. The head of Eureka's Economic Development Agency says flooded businesses are getting needed encouragement and elbow grease from members of the community.
Everyone was on the street. Can we help? What can we do? Can we clean? People were ripping out drywall. They were bringing their fans. They were saying, I'll eat at your restaurant every single day just so you guys can recoup some of this money.
That type of support is a very big incentive for Ray Bacardi to reopen his doors.
We don't have an option to just hang it up. We don't want to do that. We just feel like, you know, that it's important for all of us to bounce back and rebound. Whether we get federal assistance, state assistance, county assistance, or we have to do it on our own, we're going to come back.
Eureka's Chamber of Commerce is expecting most of its business district to reopen in March. When that happens, they're planning a makeup New Year's Eve celebration appropriately called New Year's Eve 2.0. In St. Louis, I'm Jason Rosenbaum for Marketplace.
Maybe you want to boost your immune system, or lose some weight, or put off whatever disease it is that you're worried about. If that's you, and I should say it is a lot of us, but if that's you, you probably tried or at least thought about dietary supplements. The thing is, what's on the label on those jars and bottles, and sometimes what is not on the label, could be doing more harm than good. Supplements are the subject of a new Frontline documentary airing tonight. It's called Supplements and Safety.
A multi-billion dollar a year industry.
The debate over supplements.
How could it be that you can sell something without any evidence that it's safe or effective?
Jillian Findley is the correspondent on that film. Jillian, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
First thing I need you to do, I suppose, is talk about the scale of supplements in this society, because it is enormous.
It's huge. 30-plus billion-dollar industry. Half of all Americans take some kind of a health supplement every day. There's something, it's estimated there's something like 85,000 different supplements out there, more than 4,000 manufacturers, you know, on and on it goes. It's huge.
And yet we don't really know how many, first of all, manufacturers there are, because there's no registration system. There's no government agency officially charged with formally regulating these things. I mean, there's a big black hole in there. To some degree.
A big black hole. Yeah. And I think this is certainly was a surprise to me to learn this, and I think is going to be a surprise for many viewers to learn. You know, you go to the pharmacy, you go to the drugstore, if you're buying pharmaceutical drugs, you know, you have all the assurity in the world that they have been tested, they have, been proven to be safe and effective, and there's somebody overseeing that. None of that is true when it comes to these health supplements. Often they're sold side by side on the shelves. And as a consumer, I don't think you know that.
You sat down with David Kessler, the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, who back in the 90s took on big tobacco. And Kessler called the supplement industry and the supplement regulatory case, he called it tougher than tobacco, which, I mean, I was gobsmacked because tobacco is pretty tough.
Yeah. And David Kessler, you know, is lionized in many circles because of the work he did with tobacco. And he won against tobacco. And his great regret is he didn't win in this case. You know, he said he came into office. He was aware of the problems. He wanted to get legislation approved that at the very least would force manufacturers to provide evidence if they were going to be making health claims. And as he says in the documentary, the industry went to war. They lobbied up and they won. You know, in the end, they had public service announcements. They, you know, they brought in people like Mel Gibson to help make commercials, and they encouraged people to write to their congressmen and women. And in fact, it is true that Congress received more mail over these efforts related to dietary supplements than they did about the Vietnam War.
Is it true that it is currently on the FDA to prove a supplement is unsafe rather than on the company to prove it is safe?
Yes. The only thing, and this is something that happened a few years after David Kessler, there was legislation passed that required manufacturers to demonstrate good manufacturing practices. Hmm. Now, this has to do with, you know, the whole process of how, you know, they take in ingredients and get a product out. Those practices are can be subject to inspections. But get this, you know, the FDA division that responsible for dietary supplements consists of 25 people. You've got in excess of 4,000 manufacturers out there. It's
and half of Americans taking supplements every day.
And half of Americans taking supplements every day.
I suppose, once again, this is a case of it's not surprising what's illegal. It's surprising what's legal in this industry.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think there is a surprise. You know, certainly those of us who went out to do this investigation, I mean, we consider ourselves fairly, you know, fairly educated, relatively sophisticated consumers ourselves. And, you know, every turn, you know, we were learning things that we didn't know. You know, whatever you think of supplements, whether you think they work or they don't work or whatever, you at least have the right to know what's in the bottle and have some assurance that that it is what's being advertised.
Jillian Findlay is the correspondent on the new Frontline film. It's called Supplements and Safety. It's a co-production with the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It airs tonight on PBS. Jillian, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
This final note on the way out today, in which people continue to never, ever learn. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal. It's the 2015 list of most common passwords. Number one with a bullet again, 123456. Don't do that, okay? Number two, password. Seriously, just password. New on the list this year, and the real reason I'm doing this item, at number 25, Star Wars. All one word, all lowercase, so if you're a hacker, you're welcome for that. Come on, you guys, be smart out there. Today, the Dow up 27 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ, though, down 11 points. That is 0.2%. The S&P 500 added a point. We'll call that basically even. Caitlin Ash is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishad Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.